Okay. Good morning, and welcome to our June meeting. The sun is almost going to be with us here soon. It's this June. It's been a nice wet year so far, but we need some dry weather. So we have a very busy morning this morning. We have some speakers that are very active and ready to go. So I think I always try to have something to start the meeting, but last night I had a city council till 10:30, so I'm kind of blank. I was in Salinas at 4:30 yesterday morning, so I'm like, well, what am I going to do today? And who shows up but Board Member McGrath and his crew? So it's all yours, Board Member.
Thank you. This isn't just showing off, but it is showing off. It's also relevant. I was over at my daughter's house. This is my wife and three of my four grandchildren. You've couldn't have missed the babies, Grace and Danny and my wife Colleen and my daughter Dara. But this is really about my oldest granddaughter, Cynthia. So I was over at Dara's house. And on the refrigerator, there's a certificate of achievement awarded to Cynthia Garcia for the poem Ode to a Creek. It was entered into the San Leandro Creek Watershed Contest presented by the Friends of San Leandro Creek. And I said, well, what's that about? You know, I had nothing to do with this. And it's part of the education process. Cynthia is, can you stand up, Cynthia, so they can see you? She's a third grader at Roosevelt School in San Leandro. And she wrote this poem, and I just wanted to read it to you. And so you know that it really matters, that what we do matters, that people notice that there's an education program out there. And it kind of, all the pieces fit. So it's Ode to a Creek, Cynthia Garcia. Oh, beautiful, peaceful San Leandro Creek, you are the color of silver green leaf that has fallen, that rushes like a cheetah running in habitat of San Leandro. You give us clean water. With a little art project. And she asked me when she was going to get it back, and I said, well, we'll do this. So we brought her here to give her a little extra recognition. They don't always get the recognition that babies do, but I think it's really nice to learn about clean water in third grade and do poems about it. So thank you all.
That's great. Congratulations. And since Board Member McGrath, since your family's all here, it just so happens I have Cynthia. Come on up here, Cynthia, please. Come up quickly. She can come up. She can go under there. So I happen to have, since we don't have state budgets pretty tight, Farmer John's going to give you four Farmer John pins for all your brothers and sisters. So you'll have an official Farmer John pin. I don't know if they'll give you a free pumpkin, but at least you get a pin for your brother.
They've all been photographed sitting on Farmer John pumpkins. So.
Let's get this meeting going so I can go home and plant some. So at this time, roll call, please, Mary.
Here.
Here.
Here. We do have a quorum. And so at this time, there's no introductions, I believe.
No staff introductions.
You can make your comments at the executive officer's report.
Correct.
Public forum, we have some very special cards here today, as usual. First, we'll call on John Coleman, please, to come forward. And John can give a little background, but he does have a long history in our bay and water and more to follow, I guess.
Chair Mueller and commissioners, thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I'm coming in the role of my capacity as the executive director of the Bay Planning Coalition and have worked with many of you in different capacities and invite you as commissioners in your role in sustaining the clean water in the bay and the delta that you get active with Bay Planning Coalition. We had at our last decision makers conference Mr. McGrath in attendance. We appreciate that. We also have coming up a workshop on July 21st, and it's on earthquakes and tsunamis. and it's going to be held at the PG&E headquarters in San Francisco from 8 to noon. And hopefully we'd have some staff as well as the commissioners there on that topic. We are in the process right now of lining up the speakers, but we are bringing in academia, engineers, as well as some political leaders here in Northern California who have been involved in infrastructure issues. We're going to deal with what the risks are, preparedness, and the economics of not planning as well as planning for what is going to happen here in the Bay Area and the consequences of that. I would also like to commend Commissioner McGrath. I've been working very closely with him on the Bay Plan Amendment at BCDC. He's been an active participant of BCDC, as you're probably well aware. And with much of Mr. McGrath's leadership, as well as working with the business community, which I've been part of that coalition, we have come to, quite frankly, I think, the verbiage that's necessary to garner the support to support the Bay Plan Amendment, and hopefully we'll be able to move forward with that in October 6th, I think, is the vote at BCDC. I've also worked with Mr. Wolf and appreciate all his efforts. And for those of you who are not aware of my other capacity in life, I am involved with water and wastewater. I'm the chair of East Bay Mud's Water Board, been on it for 21 years, have been president of California Association of Sanitation Agencies, and currently the chair of the Federal Affairs Committee for Association of California Water Association, AQUA, and actually running for vice president of AQUA. But Bay Planning Coalition, we are moving forward. We are going to be very proactive, and we are going to represent the business interest of Northern California and appreciate the support we've had from staff at the Regional Water Board and the support that we've had from the commissioners. And with that, I'm more than willing to take, I guess, any questions if there are any.
Thank you, John, for your dedication to all of us over the years. So,
great. And thank you.
So,
I need
luck.
To run off to another meeting, but thank you very much.
Appreciate it. We have all our friends here today. Amy, please come forward, a young woman that wears many hats over her young lifespan. So,
And as Amy comes forward, let me steal a moment. I know she's going to be recognizing a longtime member of our staff, Johnson Lamb, who as of the end of May, has retired after nearly 30 years with the Water Board. And Johnson's been one who's essentially been able to take anything he's assigned to and make it better. And that's always a great attribute. And in this case, something that he's very well known for is really developing and implementing the electronic reporting system that this board has used over the last over 10 years and has really become a statewide model. Unfortunately, the state system for electronic reporting went a little different direction than what we'd put together, but that is moving along bit by bit. But in the meantime, we're sort of ahead of the game, and I know we all want to recognize all the work that Johnson has done over the many years in his service to the state. So, and understandably, the stakeholder, the regulated community, definitely wants to recognize his efforts, and I think that's what Amy has in mind.
So. Yep. Thank you so much, Bruce, for the background and introduction. And I was wondering if Johnson could come up before I thank
Johnson.
Formally, I also wanted to just note that you're losing a number of your staff, and we're sad to see all of them go. I see Gina here, and I don't know if Heather's here, but we really enjoy working with your staff, and they're very helpful and very focused on solving problems and implementing good, sound policy. And it's always a joy to work with them, no matter what hat I'm wearing. I've always enjoyed working with them. So just to jump back, my name is Amy Chastain. I'm the executive director of the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, and our members, which include more than 40 POTWs, have had the benefit of Johnson's expertise and patience and handholding for more than a decade. And the system that he implemented has been managing the electronic reporting system has been incredibly helpful to us in permit renewals and a number of applications, also helpful to the scientists at SFEI and at your water board who use that data to help understand what pollutant loading is or are from different sources and how it affects our water quality. It's been an incredible system, and we're sorry to see it go, but we're also more sorry to see Johnson go. And I just was talking to him a few moments earlier, and I'm hopeful and expectant that he's not going far and that we'll be able to continue working with him in the future. So I have this certificate of appreciation. It's a small, small token of our appreciation for Johnson from the Bay Area Clean Water Agency, signed by myself and Ben Horenstein, who's the Bakwa Chair with East Bay Municipal Utilities District. And I'd like to present this to you. I'm going to read it if that's all right with folks. In honor and recognition of his outstanding service developing and managing a novel, because I think it was really unique at the time, electronic reporting system that improved the efficiency and consistency of reporting and that created a pollutant database used in myriad beneficial ways by the agencies and organizations working to protect San Francisco Bay. So I want to thank you, Johnson. And then I have a card that's... there's like many novels written on this card. This is signed by...
No gift certificate in there.
No gift certificate. Unfortunately, public agencies, you know how that goes. You're very familiar with that.
Save that for us.
But so a lot of heartfelt messages and notes of appreciation from all of the members of BACWA who benefited from Johnson's services. So thank you, Johnson.
Thank you.
The best part about him, he can cook, too.
Very well, yes.
What happened?
So that's another thing we're losing.
That's right. I don't know what's happening up here, but all these young guys are retiring. What's happened to us?
I'm still here.
That's right. I think next time in life we better get a job. next one is... Mr. Irvin, please come forward. Another expert in the water world and wastewater world. So we had all three here in a row, which is very unusual, and no criticism, so welcome.
Today is for a happy message. Thank you, Chairman Miller and members of the board and board staff. I just came to second some of the words that Amy had to say from BACWA. Working for the City of San Jose and the San Jose Santa Clara Water Pollution Control Plant, my group is the one that puts together our monthly self-monitoring reports and the annual reports. And without Johnson's system and Johnson's assistance over the last, well, more than 10 years anyway, and certainly about 4 or 5 years that I've been working on it, we couldn't have done it. It wouldn't have come out as well. The annual reports that we're producing now with the charts and graphs are a direct result of Johnson's database system. And we greatly appreciate the fact that, you know, much of what he does flies under the radar, I think. I know it does in our group. It wasn't until I got directly involved with SMR and then preparing those monthly reports, and you talk to the technicians and they say, well, I had to call Johnson 3 or 4 times, and, you know, and he got right back to us. He helped us out to work out, data glitches and that sort of thing. And as the new permit comes up, when our permit was renewed, for doing reasonable potential analysis, Johnson was instrumental in getting that data together. And then most recently, we went through the big project of trying to turn over to the new state CEQA system, the ESMR, and all those tweaks and fixes over the years made that transition so much easier for us. And in fact, the ERS is not really dead because it lives on in our agency. We still populate that database every month, and we'll continue to do so until our next permit, because even now there's no replacement. It's the best there is. So I just wanted to say, again, appreciation to Johnson, and we continue to rely on his good work that he's done over the years. That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you. I have no further cards, and so we'll move on to item 3, approval of the minutes for July 14th, 2010.
Move approval. Second.
Moved and second. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
So ordered. Moving on to item 4, the chair's report. Just quickly, a couple items for myself. On May 23rd, along with the executive officer who will report, we had the privilege of having a tour with Caltrans of the east span of the Bay Bridge, which was very exciting, along with a number of Region 9, we got to meet our regional administrator for the first time, and also the deputy administrator from EPA in Washington, D.C. Was out. And so we had a nice little boat tour. But more importantly for all of us, Bruce and I stuck it out till the end, and we went through the wetlands issue and the stormwater issue that we all worked on over the years at the Toll Plaza on the south side there, which we don't even notice, but we notice because it's in our business. So that was very interesting, and it was an exciting tour to see the great work they're doing on that East Span. And hopefully we'll all get to experience it soon. And Monday night we had a chair's call with the state board, and you know, there's a lot of legislation that was thrown in, and Tam is not able to make it today because of a number of things, but travel with the state is, as we all know, is locked down pretty tight right now, unfortunately. So I think the most important thing, when all the legislation that changes by the moment up there, but we'll just wait to see what comes out of the meat grinder someday here soon. The fall WQCC is on hold right now. They're not sure if Cal EPA will approve the travel to attend, which is very unfortunate, but it might come to fruition after all. And then on July 20th, there'll be a Ag Water Conservation Workshop on a webcast, too, if anyone is interested in that. So I think the most important thing, too, back to item three on the minutes there, we're getting caught up a little bit on the minutes and about that a little bit as state board chairs, or regional chairs, because of staffing and workloads and things like that. So I think the state board is not as up to date as they think they should be, too. So just for our information. So that was kind of my quick report there, and I'll let any other board members have reports, please. Yes, Board Member Moore.
Oh, real quickly, and we can keep moving. Yeah, I noticed on my Contra Costa Watershed Atlas calendar that today is World Oceans Day, so I wanted to recognize that and recognize the connection of our work to the health of the oceans. And this last month, I had the privilege of attending a talk from Dr. Steve Palumbi, who is the president or the director of Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford University. And he did he and another author put together a history of Monterey Bay called The Death and Life of Monterey Bay. And I encourage those of us in our work to take a look at that as an inspirational story about how a system can be completely crashed but come back. And also to have some insight into the interrelationship of our business and economy and the environment and how that has evolved as a culture in this country and in globally. So I think it's an inspirational story to review. And, you know, it comes back to the efforts of individuals. So I think it connects a little bit to what we heard today, the testimony of our own Johnson Lamb working in the trenches, seeing a need. You know, when I started at the Water Board, I sat across from him and I saw his wheels spin in the early 90s about all the paper that was coming in and the opportunity there was to use technology to really make a system more efficient. That all came from within him and his own personal motivation, and it's made a huge difference in terms of, you know, the way our system works. And, you know, there's stories like this in the evolution of our relationship with the environment and our economy. You know, it takes individuals to make those decisions and to inspire others to action. So thank you, Johnson. I for one, think Johnson, if he hasn't already received one, deserves a customer service award from Cal EPA. And as a board member, I would nominate him for that award. Thank you.
Yes, Board Member McGrath.
Just very quickly, I also sit on the Estuary Institute board, and we had a meeting on Friday. And at that time, the almost fresh off the press, Pulse of the Delta was available. And it's the work of the Estuary Institute. It's good ideas kind of propagate themselves at some level. That I think the term for that is memes. The regional monitoring program and its efforts have been looked on by many people as something they would like to have. And the leadership of the regional board staff, we set up an aquatic science institute as a way to utilize the scientific expertise of the Estuary Institute scientists and that mechanism. And it's come out with, I think, a real interesting look at some of the very tough issues on what's responsible for the pelagic. So I want to make sure that you guys know about it, know that it's available, and know that, again, that quiet competence of the staff You know, that idea took a lot of work to get off the ground by the staff. It's not making many ripples, but it is doing good science, and I just wanted to give a little recognition to that.
Thank you.
A few things. One, to highlight a couple of items that are in this month's executive officer's report. First, the report on noting that mercury loading from wastewater discharges is dropping. This is not only a good message, but actually ties into our pointing out the electronic reporting that here's something we're able to get in a data fashion, although this is done largely in response to the watershed permit that the board adopted in 2007 as part of the implementation of the mercury TMDL for San Francisco Bay. But it does show a good message that when we focus on a specific constituent, we can make significant progress. Certainly, the overall mercury issue is going to be a long time effort to address, but here's one loading category, wastewater, that it looks like by focusing on this, we've been able to really make significant progress. So that's a good news story. I think another good news story that's in there is noting the mitigation success at the Pacific Commons site down in Fremont. When we brought that to the board in 1999, and a very ambitious mitigation program, including development of vernal pools. And one of the board members, when we pointed out that we were going to allow mitigation on Mount Hamilton for some of the endangered plants, famously one of the board members commented, said, well, what next, mitigation at Lake Tahoe? But in this case, I think our whole mitigation package came together, and after 10 years, certainly it took some time, but we're able to say that the mitigation has been successful, and we think we've got a model that we can use elsewhere. So that's a good... Sir.
To what extent, Bruce, with this good news, are we taking advantage of it with the traditional question that I ask you is with publicity, press releases, et cetera? What are we doing on these two items specifically?
That is a good point. I think it's looking for where is the good opportunity to really broadcast that good news. Later in the meeting, when we talk about the Napa River Salt Marsh Restoration Project, we do have a press release ready to go out as soon as the board acts today. So it's looking at where we can make the bang for the buck. And so I think we'll look at these to see when it's appropriate to get the word out on these, that we ideally have a chance to get that press release picked up by somebody. So, but duly noted.
Thank you.
Another good news item that's not in the report was last Wednesday I had the opportunity to participate in, I won't say just another salt pond opening, breaching, in this case near Alviso, Pond A8 as part of the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project. The water structure was opened, and in this case, it's very significant in that it allows flow from the bay to go through a series of ponds that will now flow out right at Alviso Slough near the town of Alviso, which for many years has had a sediment problem. And so not only are the hopes that this will improve the habitat in the ponds, but provide a mechanism for keeping sediment out of Alviso Slough. And so the residents of Alviso are looking forward to this. And this is something that the Santa Clara Valley Water District has been involved in because they actually own Pond A8 and have been working with the Salt Pond Restoration Program to optimize this. So this is something we're going to look at because our other concern is that some of those sediments likely have mercury from up in the watershed. So we want to make sure that by setting up a scheme where the sediments will flow out into the bay, we're not actually causing problems from increasing the load of mercury to the bay. So it's going to be an adaptive management program, but progress continues. Another item that's not in the report, but I wanted to note that we've had a chance over the past couple of weeks to meet with representatives of PG&E on their program to do hydrostatic testing of their pipelines in response to the San Bruno explosion last fall. And I was pleased to see that they've been doing a very good job of identifying all the segments they want to test and not just say, okay, we're going to let the water after the testing go. They initially are looking at how to put this water into wastewater treatment plants, and in a few instances where there isn't a collection line nearby, looking at how they may be able to use the water on golf courses or such. So they also recognize that implies that the tests go smoothly, that then they're able to discharge the water. If the test has a leak, they obviously have to respond to any water that's leaking. So to do that, they've set up contingency plans on each of their tests and are identifying, have put together stormwater pollution prevention plans for each of those tests. And I think from the water quality perspective, this program is going to be successful. They recognize that should they identify lines that may need to be repaired or reconstructed, they may need to come back to us for water quality certification or other approvals. But for now, they're moving forward this year on their testing program. A couple of personnel items as brought up. Not only are we losing Johnson Land to retirement, unfortunately, Gina Catheria, one of our longtime supervisors and right now in the NPDES division, is going to be leaving us this month to go back to Maryland to take over the family engineering business. So it's not a retirement, but nonetheless, we're going to lose her fine services. So, Gina, thank you for all of your work over the many years. We're also losing this month Heather Ottaway, who's headed up our pollution prevention program. She's going to remain local, working for Lawrence Livermore Labs. But again, a loss, especially at a time when we can't hire from outside to replace. So we thank her for all her service over the past years. Some positives, though. Yesterday, we were able to get approval from Sacramento for our first promotion in over 3 years, that Terry Seward, who's been essentially the division chief of our groundwater protection division, officially now is a supervising engineer rather than a senior engineer. So we're pleased at that. So Terry, thanks for hanging in there all of this time. And it is the end of the fiscal year, June 30th. I won't make any forecast as to whether we have a budget by the end of that, but I do want to remind the board that since it is the end of the fiscal year, we do need to turn in travel receipts and all of that. So if you can get all of that back to us, we'll do what we can to push that paperwork through before the end of the fiscal year and everything gets tied up. So
I don't think we'll bust the state budget on our $100 fees.
not expecting to.
Turn them in.
Yeah. That's all I have.
Wow. So good luck to our members moving on in their new careers and lives. And it's, I'm sure, with sadness, Steve, that we're losing people. But, you know, hopefully new, young, energetic people step up and come forward after graduation here this last week from all the great colleges and universities in America. So, but we can't hire you. So just graduate and hang around. Hang around.
Volunteer for a while.
got a heck of a system out there going right now. So we'll get through it. So at this time, I will be doing the swearing in, and we'll start right now with all relevant evidence that any person's desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing. First by the board staff, second by the discharger, and third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested persons. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. cross-examination of any witnesses by others will be allowed. Following completion of the direct testimony by all persons, each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether he or she took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rule of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibit, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this proceeding. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand, please. Do you promise to tell the truth?
So do.
Thank you. So, all righty. Get back in gear here.
Yeah. So item five is consideration of uncontested items. I understand that we have a number of cards for item 5D, so I recommend we take that off the uncontested item calendar and hear that immediately afterwards. But items 5A, 5B, 5C, we do not have any supplementals, and we did not plan presentation on those. So I would recommend adoption of the uncontested calendar for those items.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved. Yes, sir.
I'd just like to make a comment.
Yeah.
As I started to read the Chevron item and realized how many complex units there were, and I talked to Bruce about it, I realized, first of all, I didn't want to mess with it. But the thing that I just wanted to point out is how complicated items like this, which do require tremendous oversight by both our staff and the businesses, arrive here on the uncontested calendar. You need to manage and capture contaminated runoff before it gets to the water. It's being done. It's being managed. Were there over 30 units? I mean, it's really exciting to have a project like this on the uncontested calendar, and I want to have kudos to the staff and Chevron both.
Board Member Moore?
There's a great deal of work on that item. On the item 5A, I just would point out, you know, and Bruce alluded to, you know, just another salt pond project. Each one has its own story, and this is... With Pond 7, 7A, and 8, I would just say that back in 1994, when those of us who were excited about the prospect of converting salt ponds for habitat, and these were some of the it was the Gordian knot of the whole deal, really. There was a great concern about what the materials in these ponds were, and they're known as bitter, and they're a waste product with high in magnesium concentration. And for it to be on the uncontested calendar in 2011, given, you know, the concern, and, you know, it was one of the decision points on whether or not, you know, the public agent, you know, the state of California was going to even purchase it and use the Shell Oil Trust money. And it's on the uncontested calendar because of the learning process through salt pond restoration that we've gone through collectively, as all the people involved, different roles. And it's a manageable situation, you know, and it's been managed. And we have a good model here at the Water Board to keep an eye on it, but allow the necessary flexibility to manage it for wildlife and other needs. You know, it's going to benefit the local community. And we even worked cooperatively with the Army Corps of Engineers. You know?
We're not in Mississippi.
Yeah.
It can be done. So thanks to everyone here who represents this project, and it's just one more very fulfilling salt pond project that we've all had a little part in. Thank you.
I will note on that one, 5A, that we do feel this is very significant, and as a companion to this NPDES permit that's in front of you, this afternoon will be signing the water quality certification for the physical work that's involved here, and then we'll be proceeding with the press release for that work. So while it looks innocuous, as you say, of being on uncontested calendar, it is very significant, and this is a milestone because dealing with the bitter was recognized as a challenge. We think we have a way to do it, and we think we have a model that can be used elsewhere in the Bay in the future.
I think it's well spoken by all the board members here, and again, the hard work by the staff and the regulated community of what we're all going through. It kind of catches my eye this morning with the assistant EO here with her famous iPad now banging away there. Or you don't even have to bang. It's very quiet. But, you know, considering some of us have been here since slate and chalk, I mean, there probably will come a time someday when the state would say, you know what, maybe we could go paperless here like Johnson started that thinking out there many years ago. And pardon me? We could talk to my daughter, Trudy.
So we can read them?
Yeah.
Actually, you know, we could tell an iPad story quickly here because our grandson, you know, I mean, I'm not going to let this guy get away with this deal. So our grandson loves to drive the John Deere. And, you know, so I called recently so our daughter Heidi said, Lorenzo, you want to talk to Papa? He said, nope, I'm on the iPad. I go, well, next time you want to drive the John Deere, drive the iPad, buddy, and it probably won't be long he'll be driving the iPad. So that's where we are at 4 years old, drive the iPad. So at this time, I think we still have a motion except for item D on the uncontested calendar. So moved and been seconded. Roll call vote, please, Mary.
Aye.
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 Aye. So ordered. And at this time, we will move to 5D.
5D, because it's an enforcement item, we are separating staff functions. So since I'm part of the prosecution team, I'll turn you over to Tom and Dee Dee as advisory team to the board, but at the same time, we plan to rearrange seating up here. So we'll need a moment to do that.
Okay. So, Mr. Munley, we'll get your opinion. Everybody up and back and forth. Welcome.
We can only hold it so long, too.
Could the parties who wish to testify in this matter identify themselves?
It's like a coin toss at a football game here. All right. Who gets the ball and who gets the kick?
Talk right into it.
welcome everyone. We'll start with staff presentation. Is that correct, Tom and Dee Dee? Or,
good morning, Mr. Chair.
Speak up a little bit, Dee Dee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Dee Dee Dickey, and on my left here is Tom Mumley, and we are the advisory team on this matter. As was mentioned a moment ago, the staff has split its functions on this. You will be hearing from a presentation from the part of the staff that has brought this matter before you in a prosecutorial role. And Tom and I have been uninvolved with this matter, so we will be advising you. We've had no communications about it whatsoever with the prosecution part of the staff. So we recommend that you hear first from the prosecution as to what their proposal is, and then from Shell to hear their response, and then from Signature to hear their response. Just to let the board know, after we hear the presentations, we may recommend that you consider going into closed session to deliberate on the evidence received. And so after the presentations are over, I'll mention something about that. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, do you have a question, Board Member
Morgan? I understand that we may need an executive session to talk about the legal implications, but that in no way constrains our pursuit of the factual background in this matter, does it?
That's correct. There are two possible ways that you could go into closed session. In fact, you could do both of them at once. One of them would be if there's a threat of litigation, you would be hearing advice from counsel about that. The other type of closed session could be to deliberate on the evidence received. So the parties are going to give you some evidence as to their theories about who should be named and why. And you may wish to consider going into closed session to actually talk about that. It would be my recommendation to you that if you do that and as part of your deliberations in closed session, you determine that you wish to receive additional evidence, that you reopen the public hearing at that point, or perhaps you never really closed it, but that you receive additional evidence and then proceed to make your determination.
But initially, we want a robust understanding of the factual background.
Absolutely. I think the parties should are no doubt prepared to give you a full and complete explanation of what they think you should do. And to the extent you feel that you're not getting that, I would encourage you to ask some questions before we go into closed session. Do whatever seems appropriate to you to develop the factual record to so that you can make an appropriate decision.
Yeah, and if I remind everyone to speak into the mic as loudly as possible. There's a lot of interested parties in the room, and sometimes this system doesn't work as well as it should. So please speak up into the mic. Thank you.
On behalf of the prosecution team, I would like to note that for this matter, I'm on the prosecution team, as is Stephen Hill, Yuri Wan as counsel, Diane White, Mary Rose Casa, and Cleet Carlton. Prosecution team has prepared a tentative order that would amend the existing site cleanup requirements for the former bulk fuel terminal site in Oakland. So I'd like, on behalf of the prosecution team, Cleet Carlton, to give our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and board members. I want to make sure that this is loud enough.
No, speak up. But it seems, we're all having a
point
tough
it just
time
a little bit more towards your mouth.
Okay.
Maybe we could dial it up a little bit, too.
How's this?
Getting better.
Okay. My name is Cleet Carlton. I'm an engineering geologist in the Toxics Cleanup Division at the board and a member of the prosecution team, and I took the oath. My presentation is on the tentative order for the amendment of site cleanup requirements for the former bulk fuel terminal site in Oakland. In my presentation, I will provide an overview of the site. I will discuss two key environmental concerns at the site that are prompting this action today. I will describe the tentative order that would amend the existing site cleanup order. I'll summarize the comments received, focusing on the key issues of which discharges to add. And I will close with prosecution staff recommendation.
Excuse us. We're just going to help out with the lights here.
Yeah. Yeah, we're all having a tough time hearing today. Could be our ages up here. That what you're working on, Diane?
Yeah.
I'm
complaining.
Too many John Deere tractors.
too many shells in Vietnam for you, Colonel.
What?
Are you sure I can be heard now?
Getting better, so yeah, stay great with us in the mic, please.
The site is approximately 3 acres in size and is located on the Oakland Estuary, shown here on the slide, which separates the Fruitvale District of Oakland from Alameda. The site lies just southeast of the Park Street Bridge. Starting in 1925, the site was a bulk fuel terminal, owned and operated by Shell Oil and later by Simmons Oil Company. It was used for the storage and distribution of various petroleum products. This slide shows what the site looked like in 1980, the year Shell Oil sold the site to Simmons Oil. The bulk fuel tank farm included various large above-ground storage tanks for petroleum products located here. Soil and groundwater at the site was significantly polluted with petroleum and related chemicals as a result of this operation. In the early 2000s, Signature decided to acquire and redevelop the site for townhomes. They performed site cleanup first, more on that in a moment. They completed construction in 2006. This slide shows the completed townhome complex area bounded by the red line, and here's the location of the former tank farm within the complex. These are owner-occupied townhomes with the homeowners association. Let's go back and take a closer look at the site cleanup history. Signature acquired the property in 2003 and completed soil and groundwater cleanup in 2004. They excavated and removed 23,000 cubic yards of petroleum-impacted soil, performed in-situ groundwater cleanup in the excavation area. They also installed a low permeability liner along sections of the shoreline to control petroleum migration to the estuary. This board adopted the site cleanup's requirements, the SCR, in 2004, which required implementation of the remainder of the cleanup plan, risk management measures, and attainment of cleanup standards. A key management measure was to install a vapor barrier, such as a thick sealed plastic membrane under the new buildings. The vapor barrier was to prevent the migration of vapors from residual petroleum-related contamination in soil or groundwater upward into the townhomes. This is referred to as vapor intrusion. This cleanup effort substantially reduced site pollution and the risks associated with it, and residual soil and groundwater pollution was expected to degrade naturally. Two environmental concerns remain. First, Signature informed board staff that vapor barriers were not installed during construction. Instead, moisture barriers, typically unsealed, thinner plastic membrane, were installed.
Can I ask a question on that point? I understand that the membrane was intended primarily to limit vapors. Is it also effective in reducing hydrostatic pressure and thus movement of contaminants in the ground, or is that a relevant engineering concern?
I don't believe that was a concern. It was primarily meant to...
So it's just the pathway of the vapor?
I believe so.
Thank you.
Signature's failure to install the planned vapor barrier means that vapor intrusion is now a concern. There is a need to test for vapor intrusion. The second concern is that there's a small petroleum seep at the shoreline near the former tank farm. The seep results in nuisance odors and poses a localized threat to aquatic life. The in-situ groundwater treatment and low permeability liner, which were intended to address this concern, does not appear to be effective. There is a need to evaluate the seep. We have been working with Signature to address these concerns using the framework of the 2004 site cleanup order. In 2010, we directed Signature to implement work plans to address both of these concerns. However, late last year, we learned that Signature had run out of funds and would be unable to comply with the requirements. The board item today is intended to address this situation. It would add and modify some cleanup standards to reflect current conditions. And it would also amend the order to add Shell Oil Company, the prior owner-operator, as a discharger. While we would have included Shell Oil Company in the 2004 order, our understanding then was that Signature would voluntarily complete the site cleanup requirements, and the order was uncontested. We received comments on the tentative order from several parties: Shell Oil, the Homeowners Association for the Townhome Complex, a resident of one of the on-site townhomes, and Signature Homes, an affiliate of the Signature entity that redeveloped the site. The key issue raised in these comments is whether to name additional dischargers to the site cleanup order. Both Shell Oil and the Homeowners Association have argued for naming two Signature affiliates. Shell Oil has also suggested naming Simmons Oil, an owner-operator who operated the bulk fuel distribution terminal, after them. Here we've listed the various parties that have been implicated with this site, and I'll review our rationale for naming or not naming them. Operators are listed sequentially on the left. The various Signature entities are listed on the right. Parties we think should be named have a green box around their names. Parties we think should not be named have a red box. Shell Oil and the LLC clearly qualify as dischargers, and that's not in dispute today. For background, Shell Oil Company owned and operated the bulk fuel terminal for 55 years. In 1980, Shell sold the property to Simmons Oil Corporation, who continued the bulk fuel operation. In 1985, Simmons sold the property to the Weber Trust, Iconco, who used the site for equipment storage. The Webers sold the property to Signature at the Estuary, LLC, in 2003. LLC stands for Limited Liability Corporation, and the creation of an LLC is common with residential developments. The LLC sold the property to the Homeowners Association following site redevelopment. Available records indicate that Simmons Oil and Iconco are no longer in business. The remaining issue is whether to name the LLC affiliates, Signature Properties and Signature Homes. Both Shell and the Homeowners Association have argued for naming them based on evidence that both affiliates were involved with the site. However, after reviewing the evidence, we conclude that neither affiliate should be named to the site cleanup order. Signature Homes had nothing to do with the property. Signature Properties was involved with the property, but not in a way that would make them a discharger. Signature Properties was involved with the property.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? How are they involved, and how does it not entail? And I guess my specific question there is, construction activities always have the potential to either not properly install remedial measures or to move contaminants around without proper documentation. Mm-hmm. So you've concluded that Signature Properties was involved, but I'd like to kind of pierce the evidence behind that a little more.
This is Stephen Hill, the prosecuting staff, and the next slide should address that point.
Yeah, speak okay. Everyone today. Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me now? This is Stephen Hill and the prosecuting staff, and we think the next slide will address Mr. McGrath's point.
So I'll elaborate on that last question. Signature Properties was involved with the property in two phases, before and after the LLC acquired the property in 2003. Before acquisition, Signature Properties was akin to a prospective purchaser, assessing site pollution and steps needed to deal with it. After acquisition, Signature Properties performed management tasks on behalf of the LLC, obtaining necessary land use permits and acting as a general contractor for construction activities. Water Code Section 13304 allows us to issue cleanup and abatement orders to any person who causes or permits waste to be discharged to waters of the state and causes a condition of pollution or nuisance. Under state board precedents, this includes those in current possession, ownership, or control of the property. Past owners and lessees may be named if they owned or were in possession of the property at the time of the discharge, knew of the discharge and had a legal ability to prevent the discharge. In this instance, Signature Properties didn't own or lease the property, and there's no substantial evidence that it had the legal ability to prevent the continuing discharge. Rather, it appears whatever involvement Signature had was as an agent for the property owner, the LLC. Furthermore, even if Signature Properties did qualify as a discharger, it no longer has the assets for the cleanup.
Mr. Chair, before the prosecution slide moves on to the next, before the prosecution staff moves on to the next slide, could the prosecution staff restate what Signature Properties' post-acquisition activities were?
Signature Properties performed management tasks on behalf of the LLC, obtaining necessary land use permits and acting as the general contractor for construction activities.
Now, it is the general contractor for construction activities that I'm interested in and concerned in, and I would imagine that the other parties will comment on that. But I guess the question of the prosecution staff, to what degree did that involve on-site management of the contractors doing the remedial work? Is that something we know at this time? Obviously,
this is
question out here so everybody has a chance to comment on it. You'll get your chance.
Prosecution staff can offer its thoughts about that, but you're going to hear a lot more testimony as we go on to address that point. And if you still haven't heard enough, we'd be happy to return to that. Would that be acceptable?
That's fine.
Okay.
I just wanted to highlight it as an important question.
In conclusion, we have made no changes to the tentative order in response to comments. Prosecution staff recommend that you adopt the tentative order. This concludes the prosecution staff presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for the presentation. Board members, comfortable with your earlier questions? Board Member McGrath?
We'll get there.
Yeah.
I think we've highlighted exactly the question that concerns me, which is what happened in construction.
I have two other questions.
Yes, did you speak up, please?
There was a slide shown that had a bunch of boxes on it. And I understood the prosecution speaker to indicate that can you re-clarify, are some of the parties proposing to add all of the red box entities?
Well, these are all the entities that are implicated with the site. The two that we're proposing to add, the Signature, the Estuary LLC, is already on the existing order. We're proposing to add Shell Oil to that order.
And I heard your presentation addressed why Signature Properties, why you're proposing that it not be added to the order, but not the other three. So we'll hear if the other speakers speak to the other three. Thank you.
I just wanted to support Board Member McGrath. That's there's the same question I had that Board Member McGrath posed, so I'm interested in that issue as well. Thank you.
Primarily the contractor, is that correct, Board Member McGrath and Moore? Well,
the there is certainly case law that, remember, I worked as a discharger for a while and had to sign those under penalty of perjury reports and had things go wrong in construction. If a contractor moves material and it's not properly documented what the history of that is, the entity that's contracted with the contractor is going to be liable for any kind of additional costs. So it's something that's looked at in the modern construction era very carefully as to what the nature of the oversight is, what the nature of the characterization of the soils, and the nature of change orders, because they can have first-order cost implications on your site work. So who manages the contractor and the degree to which they might deviate from the approved SCR is, I think, the most vital or one of the most vital factual questions. So I wanted to give you – I mean, if a contractor deviates from properly characterized soil, he may absorb the liability. If somebody directs him to do something else, they may. Now, I'm not a lawyer. I'm trying to use the word may, not to be dispositive, but to kind of indicate the nature of inquiry that I think is important for us to have a factual background so we can talk to our attorneys about how best to handle it.
Board Member Elihu?
The question here, really, is I understand whether to name Signature Homes or not. Isn't that the question?
I understood the prosecution staff's presentation addressed whether or not to name Signature Properties. I did not hear them address the question of whether or not – I did not hear them provide any factual information about Signature Homes.
No, I meant Signature Properties, whether to name them or not. And the question, what is the legal regulation, legal connection between Signature Properties and Signature on the estuary?
I think that's something, through the chair, I think that's something that the parties will be commenting about today, and we'll no doubt – you will no doubt have some additional questions, and I will have some questions. Under the water code, you heard the staff articulate the basis under that they believe you should apply under water code section 13304. The other parties may have some additional legal theories for us, and you'll hear what they have, and then I'll comment at that time. Thank you.
Very good. So I don't think... we have any other questions or comments at this time for the prosecutional staff. So at this time, then, we will shift over to Shell. Because So it looks like my three cards are really who's up here, who will be up here. Is that correct? I have no other cards
to go down
on this 5D.
The advisory team is not aware of any other speakers on this matter.
Okay. So we got these here.
Through the chair, if I may, this is Yuri Wan on behalf of the prosecution team. Of course, Signature is here and can best answer the question, what is the relationship between Signature at the estuary and Signature Properties? But my understanding is that Signature Property is a member of the LLC. So, you know, you've got the overlying corporation and you've got its shareholders such as Signature Properties.
Through the chair, there is a member, a representative of the Homeowners Association here over by the podium. I misspoke when I said everybody was at the table.
Okay.
And
yeah, I thought so.
I think the prosecution's attorney was speaking about the issues regarding corporate membership, and that really relates to the question of when it is appropriate under the law to, quote-unquote, pierce the corporate veil. When is a corporation serving as the alter ego of a subsidiary? Or when is, an alternate theory here is, when is a corporation so directly involved in the discharge of pollutants under the water code that that parent corporation, that the parent is so involved in the subsidiary's discharge that the parent is in fact treated as if they're doing the discharge. I did not hear the prosecution's presentation address those theories, and that's what I was alluding to a moment ago when I said that the other commenters may have some additional legal theories to offer. But since the prosecution's attorney, in effect, alluded to that, I wanted to give you a little bit of context.
Right. And I believe we do have some comments in writing here also about the separation of Signature Properties and Signature Management.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Ed Platt. I am here on behalf of Shell Oil Company. And I want to make it clear, first of all, that Shell is not here to object to its inclusion as a named party to this order. That's not why I'm here. Shell recognizes that its environmental conditions created some groundwater issues here, and we stand ready to address those. What I would like to respectfully request is that all viable signature entities be added to this order. And I would like to clarify, through my presentation, many of the questions that I've heard you ask. I would like to begin by referring to the comments to the tentative order that were submitted to you by Signature Homes. In part, Signature Homes suggests that California law is very clear in respecting the separation of legal entities. And although that is a correct statement, California law also states very clearly that if corporate entities are so intermingled as to be indistinguishable, then they are in fact liable. In this particular case, it's a question of care, custody, and control, which is language you will recognize and which is language that is very relevant to the facts before us today. Signature at the Estuary purchased this property and the property that is subject to this order and the tentative order around June 13, 2003. In the timeline that I want to present, I am going to focus on the intricacies of the relationship between these various corporate entities and their relationship even more specifically to the cleanup of this property and to their liability for the cleanup of this property. Signature Properties paid for environmental services conducted at the estuary as evidenced by checks cut for the work at the site, which I will show here in just a moment. Signature Homes, evidenced by invoicing in its environmental consultant, Lowney and Associates, appears to have had a contract to conduct geotechnical services. If that's not correct, certainly the face of the invoicing goes directly to Signature Homes. In fact, none of the invoices for this work was in fact paid by Signature at the Estuary. Signature at the Estuary LLC and Shell Oil Company entered into a settlement agreement in 2005. Shell paid Signature $1.2 million specifically for the purposes of paying for and executing the approved work plan submitted to this board. The reason this is important to Shell is that a part of that work plan included the installation of a vapor barrier, not a moisture barrier. And in fact, it is Shell's contention that the failure of Signature on the Estuary or any Signature entity to include this vapor barrier is what has caused the issues that are currently the subject of litigation between Signature and the Homeowners Association. Again, I would like to bifurcate, at least from my perspective, any interest in the vapor issues and the ongoing issues with groundwater issues that Shell knows it will be accountable for resolving. Signature Property secured a revolving loan. Yes, sir.
On that point, you're not making any allegations that in that agreement that Shell liability was in any way limited. What if I understand your argument, it's that there was an identified body of work to be done and approval, and because of the benefits in doing it in one construction item, which is commonly why these things are entered into, you agreed to pay this amount to do a specific item of work. So you've acknowledged that you have some level of remaining liability. The question and the settlement, we don't need to look in any detail at the settlement agreement because it only has to do with funding of the approved work. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
It doesn't speak to Shell's liability even at all, nor am I suggesting that it does. What I am pointing out to you is that it was based in part upon our mutual understanding that a vapor barrier would be installed in order to mitigate against the very issues that this tentative order seeks to address, and that is the issue of vapors in these condos.
Okay.
One of the things that you will see if you look carefully at the documents that have been presented, and by the way, with the exception of the invoices that you will see in this presentation, every reference to an agreement comes from documents that have already been presented to the board. We pulled them directly from GeoTracker. They were submitted to the board by Signature entities. The reason I point that out is that you can go and look at those. And it's quite voluminous, but all of those documents are a part of this record. In the various loan agreements and other documents related to the organization of these entities, what you will find is that these entities are very intertwined. Signature at the Estuary was included, at least in part, as collateral for the loans that were entered into by these various entities. And the reason I point that out is because none of these entities are bankrupt. None of them declared insolvency. Instead, they just reorganized themselves by transferring assets from one entity into another. We'll get to a slide that will illustrate that more clearly to you just by naming those entities. But one of the things I would like to clarify is that Signature Properties has also been dissolved, and all of its assets have been rolled into Signature Homes and Signature Development, Inc. So when Shell requests that the appropriate signature entities be named, it would be my suggestion that Signature Homes, Signature Development, Inc., Signature Properties, and Signature at the Estuary all be named. During a November 4th, 2008 meeting with this board.
If I may jump in and ask the speaker something. Could you clarify which entity you said has been dissolved?
Yeah, I'll get to that if you'll bear with me in just a moment. I'll give you
a lot of information on these slides about three separate entities, and we haven't really laid out what the relationship is, so it's a little confusing to hear a lot of facts. I thought I heard you say Signature Properties has been dissolved. I checked the Secretary of State's website last week, and it indicated that it has a status as an active corporation.
I think it is an active corporation, however, and I shouldn't have said dissolved. You're correct. I shouldn't have used that statement. All of its assets appears to have been contributed or used as collateral in refinancing for Signature Homes and Signature Development Corporation, which kind of lends to this point that they're really the same. They're so intertwined and so intermingled that it is quite difficult actually to distinguish one from the other.
So your testimony is that Signature Properties is an existing entity, but its assets are being used as collateral for the loan obligations of another entity.
Or contributed specifically to either Signature Homes or Signature Development. And the assets are listed with great specificity down to the make and model of the vehicles that were moving from, you know, Signature Properties into Signature Development or Signature Homes.
If I may, this is Yuri Wan again. On that issue, again, Signature is here and can speak for itself. But my understanding is that Signature Properties had certain, like, it wound up its affairs last year. It had certain assets, but its liabilities exceeded its assets. And whatever assets it did have, it sold to these new companies, Signature Homes, Inc., and Signature Development. And, you know, that's perfectly okay. It was a full arm's-length transaction, and it got full consideration for these assets. And the general rule is that a corporation that purchases the assets of another corporation don't assume their liabilities. There are exceptions, but, you know, where there is full consideration and there's an arm's length transaction, it's perfectly okay.
And although that is certainly a true statement, it is Shell's position that Signature Homes accepted responsibility for the environmental conditions that Signature at the Estuary was responsible for addressing in the earliest of days, evidenced by the fact that specific invoicing went directly to Signature Homes. In fact, you will note that these invoices didn't go to Signature at the Estuary. It references the work done there, but the invoices went to Signature Homes and references a specific contract with a geotechnical agency. A geotechnical consultant. So it is Shell's position, and I think that case law will support this, that these entities accepted and participated in this cleanup and in this liability long before the reorganization that counsel was describing. Certainly I agree that this was an arm's length transaction. However, again, the board members, the officers, the operations are indistinguishable. And if they were completely separate, then they really made a mistake by entering into a contract with Signature Homes and paying invoices on behalf of Signature on the Estuary, as opposed to keeping them clearly separate and paying those invoices specifically, you know, through some vehicle for Signature at the Estuary. That, in fact, didn't happen here. We'll look at those invoices here in just a moment. In fact, I can see that we're kind of trying to move ahead to where that intricacy might be demonstrated. Perhaps this slide doesn't do it. It just is a recital of the various ways in which they reorganized themselves at various times. One particularly interesting fact on this slide is the fact that the omnibus modification agreement that was a part of the refinancing that these various entities entered into included on its schedule the very litigation between the Homeowners Association and Signature at the Estuary, and that matter was tendered to the applicable insurance provider, which suggests to me that there is coverage here, and I find it difficult to imagine that they're not, you know, that they can claim that they are no longer viable and can't continue to function if they have an insurance policy that covers these various issues. That's not for me
like
to determine.
To remind everyone presenting, I was going to be as fair as I can with time. So
yeah.
you have a lot of good information printed here, but it's pretty small. So I know it's lengthy, so I would encourage
you
to
I'm going.
Move on.
This is just interesting. This is on the current Signature Development Group website, where it demonstrates, or at least lists, that they're managing the estuary per their website. If you'll notice down at the bottom, it actually discusses the Signature at the Estuary and further says that they have conducted site cleanup of the former Shell Oil Company bulk fuel terminal and obtained a no further action letter from the board. I was unaware of such a letter issued in this particular instance, but this is the Shell, this is the Signature Development Group's website. So clearly they are suggesting that they are accountable for the work at Signature on the Estuary. They're listing it here on their website and taking credit for performing cleanup on behalf of Signature on the Estuary. In terms of corporate governance, and we'll just go through this quickly, I would like to point out that the law suggests that when you cannot distinguish the various entities in terms of its daily operations or even its board members and officers, that they will be liable for some of the reasons that you asked about earlier. These entities appear to be governed by a three-member board, typically comprised of James, Lori, and Michael Gilmetti. I believe this to be mother, father, and son. They appear on every board, or at least in some variation of every board. James was the president of Signature Homes, the president of Signature Properties, the chief executive officer of Signature Properties, the president of Signature Properties at various times, and a member of the board of the Estuary. Michael, president of Signature Properties, and also of the development group. I only mean to point out here that they are so intertwined and interrelated as to be indistinguishable. I think they should be added because I think they are, in fact, liable based upon their own actions at the site. Signature on the Estuary, it appears, was managed by Signature Properties and through various either loan instruments or reorganization instruments contributed their assets and operation management to either Signature Homes or Signature Development Group. And again, at least part of this is referenced in their own website, Signature Development, Inc., at least.
Excuse me. I'd like the speaker to clarify the last slide. Can you go back to the last slide?
Uh-huh.
This would seem to suggest, the way the arrows are pointing, that Signature at the Estuary is the parent corporation. However, the materials that you provided indicate that it was formed after Signature Properties,
Inc. Yeah, that's not what I mean
to
suggest at all.
Can you indicate which you believe to be the parent corporation?
Yeah, in this instance, you wouldn't be able to characterize it that way. So don't. I apologize if that's what you think the arrows mean, because that's not it. Instead, Signature at the Estuary was one of many development projects that were initially managed by Signature Properties. There are Signature developments all over the Bay Area with various names, and they typically are Signature at the Estuary, Signature at such and such bay, Signature at wherever. They were managed by Signature Properties. The assets, including Signature at the Estuary as collateral, were used in the financing vehicles that created, or in the reorganization or restructuring, created Signature Homes, were either contributed into Signature Homes or Signature Development Group. That is in the voluminous documentation that they provided to you, but if you look closely at the documents, you will find assets from Signature at the Estuary, either that as collateral, or assets from Signature Properties contributed specifically to either Signature Homes or Signature Development.
So if the speaker could clarify, is the Signature Properties the parent corporation?
No, I don't think it is. I don't think there is a parent company. I don't think that's what this relationship looks like.
So they all have, in some sense, equal status. They're just four separate entities, and the arrows don't indicate
That's
kind
correct.
Of formation
they don't indicate
formation.
No, not at all.
If we can stay here for a minute, certainly there's a financial connection, and the question, which I don't think we can parse here, is to what degree those financial connections were independent or arm's length and the like. And I'm not terribly interested in that. I am interested in oversight decisions. And the fact that the boards are identical means perhaps the same people were making the decisions, depending on to what degree the individual projects were managed by a project manager. But the most interesting and I think pertinent argument you've made is that Signature Properties had a role in management that was not truly at arm's length from Signature at the Estuary, and so that's been alleged, and so far the only evidence that I've heard about that is the payment of the invoices. So I would be very interested in any other evidence you had on that connection about the actual management of the building activities.
Well, I can't speak specifically to the management activities of these various entities, but if you look carefully at the correspondence between Signature Homes, Signature Properties, or Signature at the Estuary, what you will find is there isn't a single piece of correspondence to the board from Signature at the Estuary. Instead, the correspondence comes from either Signature Properties or Signature Homes. The signatures that you will find are either James or Michael Gametti, typically James. My point is that although Signature at the Estuary may have had title to the property, the actual work was performed by the same individuals and the same corporation that became Signature Homes or Signature Development Group. Let's look at the invoices here for a moment,
so
and I think you'll see.
So you're saying the financial responsibility did not lie in a truly separate manner at Signature at the Estuary, but in fact...
I see no invoice to Signature at the Estuary. Okay. I see no check cut by Signature at the Estuary, and I see no correspondence from Signature at the Estuary. So if you go... start looking at these invoices. This is an invoice sent specifically to Signature Properties. Its project is 303 to 335 Derby Avenue, so clearly it is the Signature at the Estuary work, and it was made payable to Signature Properties. And the check was issued by Signature Properties. The reason I included all three slides is because there were multiple invoices that were consolidated together in the payment, which is why I've highlighted the various amounts. Here is another invoice. This one is issued to Signature Properties for the same work and also paid by Signature Properties. Here we have an invoice from Lowney and Associates made payable to Signature Homes per a specific project number. The date of this particular invoice is through 2004, which is the time period that we're discussing in terms of the work that was done there. Again, referencing a specific contract number to Signature Homes and itemizing specifically the Estuary property and work done there. I won't take up a lot more of your time. If nothing else, I would suggest that there is sufficient confusion, in my opinion, to justify the inclusion of all Signature entities on this order. My concern is that in correspondence from Signature Properties to the board, they essentially said, yes, we submitted work plans to you. Yes, we agreed to do work. But at some point they threw up their hands and said, you know, but we don't have any more money. And so, you know, why don't you guys go look to Shell Oil Company? Perhaps they can complete this work. I recognize that Shell has liability for groundwater issues here. But at the very least, Shell is hopeful that we might come to the point where we can bifurcate these vapor issues from the groundwater work. And certainly it is Shell's desire that at the very least this order include all of the signature entities. Let them duke it out, quite frankly. I believe that there is sufficient case law and sufficient statutory law to suggest that these entities are not separate. And even evidenced by, the documentation of invoicing, I would respectfully request that these entities be added. That's my request.
Thank you. Any further questions of the speaker? Very good. Back to signature. You're welcome to speak there if you're comfortable with the microphone. Okay. We just need to know what signature you're with here.
Certainly. I'll clear that up at the outset. Good morning. My name is Mark Stice. I am an attorney for three entities involved, Signature Properties, Inc., Signature Homes, Inc., and Signature Development Group, Inc. I am not here today representing Signature at the Estuary, LLC. But I would like to take the opportunity, and thank you for the opportunity, to respond to some of the information that Mr. Platt has provided to you on behalf of Shell Oil. First of all, I think it should be important to discuss a little bit about the constitution of the separate legal entities that we have involved or have been referenced in this matter today. Initially, you have Signature at the Estuary, LLC. It is a California limited liability company, and it has the ownership of that entity is through the various members that own a membership interest in that legal entity. And so there were at least two owners, trust for the benefit of James and Lori Gilmetti and a trust for the benefit of Michael Gilmetti. And that constituted the ownership of that entity, and then that entity, that Signature at the Estuary LLC as an entity, separately owned various assets associated with the estuary project. It was the entity that acquired title to the property and improved it and sold the various units. That entity retained Signature Properties, Inc. as a manager, not as a member. So Signature Property, Inc., as a separate legal entity, never had any ownership in the Signature at the Estuary LLC entity. And I think that's an important distinction. Signature Properties, Inc. is a California corporation, and it is owned by its the ownership of that entity is through its various shareholders. Initially, it was owned by a trust for the benefit of Jim and Lori Gilmetti and a separate party. Jim and Lori Gilmetti bought out the corporate shares of that party and sometime at a later date sold certain shares to a trust for the benefit of Michael Gilmetti. That entity, again, is a separate legal entity, and it was operated by its directors, officers, and employees.
Can you describe them? You said that it was retained as a managing company. Is there any exhaustive description of what the management responsibilities are?
Certainly. It was as the development manager for Signature at the Estuary LLC and in any number of other LLCs formed for real estate projects. Signature Properties, Inc. Implemented accounts payable, entitlement, served as the general contractor, provided customer service services to the various project entities.
So in that respect, it would not be unusual or corporate intermingling, for example, for Signature Properties to pay the bills because that's what they had been set up to do?
Yes. And one of the functions is the accounts payable, and because of the information submitted by Shell, I think it's very important. Signature Properties, Inc. managed up over 20 entities at any given time. And one of the functions that it served for those entities was to manage the accounts payable, the contracting, the the approval of invoices and the payment of invoices. For some, but not all of the entities, it facilitated this process through the use of a construction management account. So it had a single management account where it would take funds paid into that account by its various entities that it was managing.
The investors?
Actually, the entities. Okay. So the entities would have funds available to pay for the costs associated with the individual projects through capital contributions from the members to the entity or for proceeds from various acquisition or construction loans obtained by those entities to pay the project costs. So those funds would be deposited into this construction management account on behalf of the entities. Signature Properties, Inc. maintained a daily ledger as to the deposits of those various entities and would pay.
I think I'm satisfied on the accounts payable question. Perhaps Dee Dee's not, so I'll let her go.
I have what I hope is a quick question on the accounts payable. I believe I'm hearing you say that there was a single account from which the bills of various entities were paid.
That's correct.
And was there an accounting process by which then the individual entity was billed for the payment that was made out of the single account?
Yes. There was a daily ledger that was maintained, and so each entity would have a balance within that account, and the cost of the individual projects would be charged to that balance.
How did Signature Properties LLC pay back what it owed? That's what I'm understanding.
Signature at the Estuary LLC?
I'm sorry, Signature. How did the LLC pay back what Signature Properties, Inc. had paid on its behalf? I don't understand what running a balance means. I'd like to run a balance too, but I have to pay my bills.
Certainly.
But how did the LLC pay its bills?
Certainly. As previously mentioned, Signature at the Estuary LLC would obtain funds either through capital contributions from its members or on draws from various acquisition or construction loans obtained, in this instance, from Wells Fargo Bank.
And you wouldn't want to move money into that and either incur loss of income in another investment or interest payments until you had to. So I understand the accounting practice. And as long as there's a very clear separation of the funds in the billing chain and the roll-up, I don't think there's necessarily anything that entails responsibility. But I would like you to talk about construction management, because that appears to be one of the elements here. And I would be particularly interested if there was a single entity responsible for construction oversight and whether or not there were any written descriptions of the actual responsibilities and the decision. There's, of course, a decision at question here, which is the placement of a different type of membrane, which is very relevant to the entire consideration. And so I'm very interested in how that decision got made, who that entity worked for, and what degree of instructions they had from whom.
In its role as development manager, in Signature Properties, Inc.'s role as development manager for Signature at the Estuary, it also acted as the general contractor for the project. And in that role, it was charged with constructing the improvements shown on the approved plans and specifications for the project. And one of the approved plans and specifications included a foundation design. And on that foundation design, unfortunately, it was approved to install a moisture barrier versus the vapor barrier. And that was what was installed by Signature Properties, Inc. in the construction of the townhomes.
Who managed the contract that installed the vapor barrier versus the moisture barrier?
Signature Properties, Inc. was the general contractor. So it managed all of the suppliers and the subcontractors for the various elements of the construction of the project.
Is there any documentation you have of the decision-making on that going to anyone other than Signature Properties, Inc., or was that the discretion that they were responsible for as the general contractor?
The documents involved would have been the operating agreement designated Signature Properties, Inc. as the manager and the various approved plans for the construction of that component of the project, the foundation.
Okay.
So,
can I ask
a question?
Yes.
We know where that box
approval
stops.
Approval of public lines, approved by whom when you say an approved plan, yes. When you're referencing this, the foundation and approved plan
and
that resulted in building a moisture barrier versus a vapor barrier, who approved that?
And that's a very good distinction. That plan was not approved by the Water Board. It was approved by the City of Oakland. And under a geotechnical review versus a environmental review. So with respect to the geotechnical aspects, and I'm sorry, I know you want to ask a question, board member. With respect to the geotechnical aspects, the City of Oakland had the oversight and approved it for purposes of providing structural support to the various foundations, but not from an environmental perspective.
Shalom.
Who made the decision to change from vapor barrier to moisture barrier?
I'm unaware of a decision made saying we have an obligation to install a vapor barrier, however, we'll install a moisture barrier instead. The construction process proceeded at this particular project proceeded through various departments under the oversight by Signature Properties, Inc. as the general contractor. Basically breaking down between implementation of the environmental cleanup plan and installation of the infrastructure, horizontal infrastructure on the site, the various streets, utilities, and grading for the infrastructure and the implementation of the soil removal and groundwater treatment. That was handled by one department referred to as the offsite department. The construction from basically the soil up, beginning at the foundation, which involved the moisture barrier versus the vapor barrier, was handled by a separate department. And it was in this transition where I believe that the obligation to install the vapor barrier was missed, and in fact was installed by installed the moisture barrier instead.
Is there any evidence on either side as to estimates that came into any of these signature entities of the cost of installing a moisture barrier versus a vapor barrier?
I don't have that information today.
Can we get it?
I can look for it. So.
I mean, somebody came up with this idea.
Somebody made a change order.
And there's going to be a paper
trail
somewhere.
That's a big decision to make that change.
All right. Sure. I'm going to get board member Moore here.
Yeah. Well, I've been through a few plan development processes as a registered civil engineer. So, and from that perspective, I can see a spectrum of explanations here. Mm-hmm. And one of which is benign. It was an error. Lost through the shuffle. So what I'm interested in terms of the question before us is, you know, I could see this could come from, you know, whoever's developing the plans, that the civil engineer, and, you know, you ever played the telephone game where you get, you know the telephone game where you whisper in somebody's ear and you get something, and with all these different approvals, an error could have been propagated in miscommunication. So what I'm interested in is either the architect or, you know, architectural firm or the civil engineering firm that developed the plans that had what may just be a benign error, you know, who had the contract with that firm? Was it Signature Properties? Was it Signature Homes? Was it Signature at the Estuary or the Development Corporation? Yeah, so... Do you have the question? Can you answer that question?
I believe I do. And it goes to the various contracts involved in this particular component of the project. And Signature Properties, Inc., again, as the general contractor, oversaw the design contractors and the construction contractors. Typically with foundation design, you would involve two different disciplines, soils engineering and and civil engineering. Mm-hmm. And here, we also have the environmental engineer as well, because you have the site remediation work that predated the installation of the foundation. Signature at the estuary, the project structural engineer who provided who I understand provided the specs for the foundation, and I'll have to check this. It would either have been Lowney & Associates, who was the original geotech, or... And I'm sorry, I just lost the name. It'll come back to me. TerraSearch. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and this is no disparaging for company.
Certainly.
As far as responsibility, I'm interested in that relationship. If the error in the issue of compliance ties back to that issue, what entity is connected to that technical expertise? I think is pertinent.
Yuri?
Sorry, if I may. This line of questioning is very interesting. Of course, we want to know who messed up, who installed the material, who installed the incorrect thing. But that doesn't really answer, if we answer that question, I don't think that we can name that person as a discharger. To name a discharger, that person has to have caused or permitted waste.
Right. Well, I guess where I'm going with this is I'm not trying to find fault, that kind of thing. It's more that, that who has oversight, like you say, and who is responsible for that oversight of that work?
I think, Steve, it's actually a little more than that, because the testimony that we've received so far is that the management company, Signature Properties, Inc., was responsible for both the entitlement part of the work, the design part of the work, and the construction oversight of the work. So their management role goes directly to the question of was the entitled remediation plan properly installed. And it doesn't look like that responsibility lies anywhere else. So, I mean, I'm on this chain of information, I cannot but see how Signature Properties does not have enough direct involvement in the decision-making from soils work through entitlement, through preparation. I mean, Lowney remained involved in not just the preparation of the plan. Now, if the individual entities didn't communicate well enough, I mean, that could be quite benign. I've made big mistakes, too. But the question here is not who's responsible. It is does one of the entities have a sufficient role in the oversight? And they were hired to do that. They were hired to do entitlements, oversight of foundation plans, structural work, and the connections between those two are all vital, but they all go to the question of, at least on the vapor portion, I can't see, but the Signature Properties didn't have a significant role.
It was an implementation role.
Right.
I mean, the ownership role, staff's done a great job of really working hard to tease through what the issues might be. There's an implementation of the order role that emerges from this web of interconnectedness.
If I may, that point for the board members.
It's a question.
I think a further distinction on that point, because I'm not here today to say that Signature Properties Inc. was not involved in the construction of the implementation of the remediation plan or the construction of the project. However, I think it would be a further distinction and pertinent question is whether or not in the implementation of that portion of its scope of work, did it cause a discharge or involve in any other activity that would provide a basis for being named as a discharger under the order. Okay. And although the installation of the vapor barrier was a involved in the remediation plan, the failure to install the vapor barrier did not create a discharge to waters of the state. So the work that Signature Properties was doing was to remediate discharges that were already there. I don't think we have any. There is no evidence that the the soil and groundwater work that Signature Properties implemented, it created an exacerbation or any new contamination. So it's on that point that in the implementation of its development management role, that Signature Properties believes that there is no basis to name it as a discharger under the order.
You think, to paraphrase your argument, that the distinction between the vapor barrier, where there's a clear chain of evidence question, and the discharge is right. are two different chains of potential pathways, and the vapor barrier question doesn't relate clearly enough to an actual discharge.
That's correct.
Okay. Can I ask the executive director a question? Adding one or more signatories at this time doesn't mean that they stay involved for all time. When I began to look at this and hear the testimony, it seems that we have a factual question here that we don't understand and a pathway to do some more remedial work. We don't understand if the discharge is a result of improper construction or characterization and remedy that wasn't sufficient. And we need to do some more work before we can tell that.
Before the executive officer answers that question, I just want to clarify, I have Mr. McGrath clarify whether his question to the executive officer is in the executive officer's capacity as EO or in his capacity as a member of the prosecution staff. Mr. Mumley is your technical right. advisor here today.
Yeah, maybe you should address it to him.
Then I've asked the wrong person. Thank you for redirecting me. It seems to me that there is a factual question that's unresolved here, which is whether or not Signature Properties might, at the end of the day, stay in the responsible party question, or whether or not the characterization was insufficient for whatever reasons. And that then goes to what was left on the site. So there's two separate questions. How well characterized was it and how effective was the remedy? Or was it properly constructed? And I can't see anything here in the information before us that is dispositive of that one way or the other. Certainly the gentleman from Signature Properties has suggested with some persuasion that there's no clear link between vapor barrier questions and discharge. On the other hand, it's pretty clear that they had a significant role in the construction oversight, and we don't know exactly what was in the ground. So in my mind, if they're put in at this time and later evidence shows that, in fact, this was an improper characterization, not an improper construction, they might at a later date be removed. Is that does adding them at this time in any way prejudice the downstream question when we have more facts? To steal your phrase, your term. And if our attorney wants to suggest that we discuss this in closed session, I would be happy to take that advice.
I think it'd be appropriate to discuss some of this in closed session. I think there are a couple of big legal theories as to why one would or wouldn't name another corporation. One is that the second corporation really functioned as if it were the first corporation. It really ran the show. It was the same people. It ran the show. It made the decisions. It, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So various aspects of that test. The other is that the other corporation essentially caused the discharge. It did something that what caused the discharge, whether it caused the initial discharge or it caused it later on, it caused the discharge. So those are two really separate but related legal questions.
Let me add to that, just in a general rule. We're not required to name all parties, but we're expected to make a reasonable effort to determine the facts to name all appropriate parties. That translates into the possibility that additional parties could be added
at a later
future time, ergo what's going on right now. That shell was not on the earlier order. It's now being proposed to be on this order. I believe the same thing goes as pulling somebody off. If further investigation determines new facts that would give us cause to say,
so it's not
change somebody's
I don't believe there is
prejudicial on either side.
I think it can move either way. I believe this board has named parties in other orders with reasonable confidence that they have a role, but as part of the ongoing investigation, there was opportunity to bring back additional facts that could give you cause to reconsider whether they should be sustained as a responsible party. So
I'd like you to kind of summarize and conclude, if you could, please. I think we're getting the gist of things here.
Certainly. And to the point of the separation of the various entities, Signature Properties, Signature at the Estuary, Signature Homes, and the Signature Development Group are all separate entities. They are separately owned, separately capitalized, and at no time has one of those entities assumed the liabilities of the other entity. Mr. Platt, on behalf of Shell, represented that assets were contributed by Signature Properties, Inc. to Signature Development Group or Signature Homes several times throughout his presentation. I believe that is loose and improper language, as was clarified by board staff. In the letter from Signature Homes, the purchase and sale agreements of the purchase of certain assets, not all the assets, of Signature Properties, Inc., between Signature Properties and Signature Homes in one transaction for which independent consideration was paid for the assets purchased, and a second transaction between Signature Properties and the Signature Development Group, again, where independent consideration was provided for the assets transferred. There is no contribution. A contribution would refer to an owner providing assets for no consideration other than an ownership interest in an entity, as happened with the members of the LLC to Signature the Estuary. That did not occur here. So these were arm's length transactions where independent consideration was paid for assets, no liabilities with respect to the estuary project were assumed. With respect to the invoicing that was materials that was supplied by Shell in their presentation, again, with respect to the invoices submitted to Signature Properties and paid by a Signature Properties check, this was a function of the construction management account that I referred to earlier. The invoice submitted by Lowney & Associates that addressed to Signature Homes was an error. If you look further into, and you will see that Shell did not provide a copy of a Signature Homes check in payment of that invoice. Okay. The invoices on this project would have been paid through the Signature Properties, Inc. construction management account. You can tell by the invoices, the one that is addressed incorrectly to Signature Homes was for a contract for the geotechnical services provided by Lowney & Associates. The invoices correctly addressed to Signature Properties were for the environmental preparation of the environmental documents. So this is an addressing error by a third party to this matter, and we can provide a copy of the underlying contract to show that it wasn't with Signature Homes. Mr. Platt also referenced a reorganization. It was not a corporate reorganization. There was a debt restructure that involved various borrowers, which included project entities and Signature Properties. There was not a corporate reorganization whereby the assets of one entity were transferred or contributed. There were purchases and sales, not contributions. And I believe Mr. Platt concluded his presentation on the basis that there's sufficient confusion that would merit adding one entity on as responsible for the liabilities of another entity. I'm unaware of a legal basis where confusion is a sufficient basis, and I would urge you to follow staff's recommendation and not add Signature Properties, Signature Homes, or the Signature Development Group.
Thank you. Ms. D.
I have a follow-up question on the invoicing. I believe I understand the theory you're laying out regarding why Signature Properties paid the invoices that were due for work that signature the LLC had contracted for. I don't see any evidence that you provided of then when the LLC then was billed for and paid those liabilities. I understood you to say that they ran ran a balance, but I'm not clear on what the process was and what the evidence is that shows that the LLC then paid those amounts.
And those would be the deposit of construction draws or contributions from the project loans, or whereby Signature at the Estuary was the borrower. And so if the board staff would like that information, I would have to put that together.
So can you clarify, did Signature Properties invoice the LLC?
Sorry. The project, all the project costs for the implementation of the remediation and construction of the homes were paid by Signature at the Estuary. So yes, the costs that were paid by Signature Properties Inc. through the construction management account were ultimately paid by Signature at the Estuary LLC. And I can't tell you today what the actual accounting process is, but I can provide that information at a later date.
What was the lag time?
I believe construction draws were taken down either on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. So it would have been concurrent with the payment of the invoices and the submittal for the construction draws for the work and the payment of those funds.
And were there invoices that indicate that would support your apparent theory that this was an arm's length transaction, that the LLC was paying its bills? Were there invoices provided to the LLC and the LLC then paid those?
Again, I believe there is paperwork. I can't tell you today what the header on that paperwork was, whether it was an invoice or a construction draw or other document, but to follow the flow of the costs submitted by the contractor or consultant through the ultimate payment we could provide you with that information that tracks the payment of the costs from the construction management account and the deposit of the funds by Signature at the Estuary.
Thank you at this time. Thank you for your patience.
But all right. Is it my turn?
Mark, yeah, and you have to help me on the
okay.
Lot.
Intrary.
Intrary, okay.
Thank you very much. I represent the Estuary Homeowners Association and a very large number of the individual homeowners who live there. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I just wanted to address a couple of points that I think I might be able to help clarify and embellish a little bit. First of all, in the interest of full disclosure, I must tell you that my firm is in litigation with Signature over the issues regarding the site, and we have been asking for a lot of the documentation that you've been asking questions about and wondering about here for the last 6 months, and there's currently a motion pending with the court that will be heard in June where production of a lot of those site development documents and corporate documents pertaining to the relationship of all these various entities, I expect will be produced to us. We've been asking for a lot of that information for a very long time. A couple of quick points. It's important to know, I think, and Mr. Platt laid out a lot of this already, so I won't belabor it. It's important to know that Signature Properties contracted with Loney and Associates to do the preliminary geotechnical site investigation on this property before Signature at the Estuary was even formed. They contracted with Loney and Associates, and the corrective action plan was submitted in October of 2002. Signature at the Estuary wasn't even formed until December of 2002. Those geotechnical experts retained by Signature Properties analyzed the site, and that is what led to the recommendation to install the vapor barrier. It's absolutely critical, and I think a couple of your board members have picked up on this, it's absolutely critical to know that Signature Properties was the general contractor on this site. The question was oversight. I've been doing construction litigation for 25 years. The general contractor, and this is a statement of law, the general contractor is always responsible for everything that goes on the construction site, including oversight. So the failure to install a vapor barrier falls at the feet of the general contractor, period, end of story. They have an oversight responsibility. They either did it or they didn't. Obviously, here they didn't. Now, they can point the finger at their subcontractors or their design professionals, but they've contracted with their design professionals. The design defect that Mr. Stice refers to, again, lies at the feet of the general contractor. That's their responsibility. So the oversight function was Signature Properties, Inc., as general contractor, period, end of story. The other thing that's critical to know is that Signature Properties, Inc. was the managing agent for the LLC. Not only were they the general contractor, but they were the managing agent of the LLC. Now, Mr. Stice makes a very subtle distinction when he talks about this that's important to point out. There is a difference, presumably, between, I would say it's a distinction without a difference, but there's a technical difference between being the managing agent of the LLC and a member of the LLC, which we believe Signature Properties is. My understanding is that Signature Properties, Inc. is the managing member of the LLC. Now, Mr. Stice suggests they are not. It's one of the reasons we've been asking for all the corporate documents so we can find out exactly what that relationship is. Regardless, the Gilmettis are members of the LLC. The Gilmettis are the shareholders of Signature Properties, Inc. And Signature Properties, Inc. is the managing agent of this project and the general contractor. To say there's any distinction between the Gilmettis, who are the shareholders of Signature Properties, Inc., and the owners of the LLC, it's a fiction. And again, it comes back to the critical fact that Signature Properties, Inc. was the general contractor for this project and had oversight responsibilities. Now, the question of whether there's ongoing discharge, I would remind the board that in a prosecution staff's presentation, they alluded to the fact that there's an ongoing discharge at this very day of petroleum byproducts into the estuary. It's ongoing. I'm sure that wasn't an intended result of the construction of this site. That, again, is a mistake, and it's an ongoing mistake that's polluting the estuary. So there's continuing discharge. There's soil vapor discharge by virtue of the failure to install the vapor barrier. And all of the oversight falls at the feet of Signature Properties, Inc. There is no distinction here to be made that would militate in favor of not naming them as a discharger. All the evidence is quite to the contrary. That's all I had to say, unless there's questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your presentation. And I believe homeowners are here also. Is that correct? Any homeowners with you? So, okay, so thank you. My advisory team. I think we've heard a lot of testimony. I don't know if there's a need for us to go to closed session. What's your recommendation, advisory team?
I believe that I understood that one of the members here said that he had some things he wanted to discuss in a closed session. So I recommend that the board go into closed session to deliberate on the evidence received, that you close the public hearing first. When you come back from closed session, after you've had an opportunity to deliberate, that you have the option to reopen the public session as you wish. If there are additional questions that you want to ask any of the parties to provide additional testimony and evidence.
Okay, so board members, we will move to closed session, and we'll have to do it in this room, I guess. We don't have much choice to go anywhere else. So Unfortunately, we have to clear the room for we'll notify you. I don't think it'll take much more than 15 minutes, do you think, advisory team? Give you all a break, and we don't get one.
Excuse me. Before the board staff leaves the room, we need somebody who is skilled in microphone turn-off to turn off the microphones.
We need the kill switch.